Good evening and welcome to Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner and happy to be with you. And I want to thank each and every one of you for your much needed support during our recent pledge drive. This radio can't happen without you. So thank you again. We're kind of all in this together, aren't we? Good thing, given the state of the world we find ourselves in. I believe our connection with each other will grow and grow. We have a very special person with us tonight discussing a very important topic, a topic that touches almost everyone, child sexual abuse, the violation and terrorizing of innocent, vulnerable, and helpless children by primarily men. This topic is heavily in our news right now with the Catholic Church and the role of the Pope in the recent scandals with its list of sickening horrors. And there is the upcoming trial of Aaron Vargas in our own community, in which sexual abuse figures heavily. My guest this evening is Marlene Mish, Executive Director of the Children's Advocacy Center of Jackson County, Medford, Oregon. And we're going to have a little music, and I'll be right back.
Our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play. While inside is an aching that won't go away, and we wonder why in heaven are we here today? We fight with our children, wives and husbands too. Angry, hurtful feelings running clear through. And the pain of it all dulls all that we do. And we wonder how much more we have to suffer through. The daily news tells our story, sad but true, of violence and killing and wars planned anew, of child abuse and battering done by men the world through. And we women wonder why must we be here too? It's hard to watch the pain and strife go on. The cries of our children lost in the dim. But until men's hearts are opened to the love that lies within, there can be no peace on earth, no joyful life beyond. Constant love so true is the only way to heaven and peace on earth too. And so I tell you in words straight and true, open up your heart to the pain that covers you. For it's the
you've just been listening to me. That is Our Life Goes On from my first CD, Okwaka Speaks, The Words and Music of Mother God. My guest, Marlene Mish, has 40 years' experience working with children as teacher, counselor, principal, and child advocate. A graduate of UCLA, she holds teaching and counseling credentials and is an experienced trainer on all issues of adolescent development, mentoring, and parenting. As a trainer of trainers for the Darkness to Light, Stewards of Children Child Sex Abuse Prevention Program in Jackson County, she hopes to facilitate a paradigm shift where adults take responsibility for the safety of all children. The Children's Advocacy Center of Jackson County is a grassroots community project to provide a home-like environment where child victims of abuse can disclose abuse to law enforcement and child protective workers in privacy and safety, and can receive services in one child-friendly location. By redesigning the system with the special needs of children in mind, the center reduces the trauma of abuse and provides coordinated support services for child abuse victims to begin their healing process. In 2009, Marlene was named to the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force Offender Response Committee. She is a member of Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, a member of SART Sexual Assault Response Team in Medford, Oregon, trainer, primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention of abusive behaviors in childhood and adolescent. She's a facilitator of grief counseling workshops, provides hospice training, and received the Honorary Service Award for recognition of outstanding service to children and youth from the California State PTA. Welcome, Marlene, to Women's Voices.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
You've been a busy lady.
Yes, just hearing you say all those things made me feel very old. It took a long time to do those things.
I'm sure it did, and I only covered maybe a fourth of the list.
Right.
Well, that's wonderful. That's really, really admirable. Obviously, you've had a direct calling, or you just kind of were on the path. You knew you were on the path, it would appear. The first question I ask my guests is, what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, I was surprised and actually happy that you asked that question. The first words that came to my mind without any filtering was just the words courage and willpower and the fearlessness to stand for what you believe in. Those were, I think, the qualities that my mother had and gave to her three daughters. And then I think the underlying thing of all that has really guided all of my life really is that that being a mother is a sacred task. And so for me, motherhood is what I actually wanted to grow up to be, is to be a mother. So as it turned out, I got to be the mother of many children.
So you have three. You had two sisters.
I have two sisters. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. But I haven't had a mother since 1981. And for all of those out there who have lost their mothers, that's a very profound loss. And so I'm always happy when I have a chance to acknowledge that I wouldn't be here on Earth, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't be doing what I was doing if I hadn't had her. The lessons that she taught me, some not so, easy, and some that were great gifts.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about your journey from growing up to where you are now, and the journey to becoming the fierce advocate for children that you are now? Please take your time.
Yeah, okay. Well, actually, that's also an interesting question, and. From where I began, I think the word fierce warrior would never have applied because I really came into the world in a classic dysfunctional home which had generational issues of abuse. I don't think there is an abuse out there that was not existing in my environment, whether that be physical abuse, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence, mental illness. I mean, it was all there, and that all adds up to kind of a formula for chaos and fear. So I was a very shy little girl. So I think if someone would look at the paperwork at the beginning, they might say, well, that child is never going to amount to anything because she doesn't have really a ghost of a chance. And yet, because I had one, the love of one person, and that is my mother, and two, an opportunity to get an education, I was able to embark on a path. And I really think that those beginning things, which were very impactful and tragic in some ways, were also the beginnings of the warrior. And so I went from that kind of environment in South Central Los Angeles, and because I am from California, so it's nice to be speaking to California tonight, really brought up in a very poor neighborhood, and South Central is can be a very frightening neighborhood as well. And from that to, UCLA and being exposed to other countries, and then getting a job as a teacher at Beverly Hills High School, of all places, which, is the antithesis of my upbringing, and being exposed to many things there, and raising three children, being a teacher for 15 years, a counselor for 15 years, and then leaving California to come to Oregon to what I thought was going to be a chance for me to be creative and write, and maybe give seminars or facilitate workshops, and that's really what I thought I was coming to Oregon to do. And then found myself teaching classes on domestic violence and helping victims of domestic violence, which opened up what I thought at the time, this is really ironic actually, I thought at the time was like a brand new field for me. Then I became a principal of an alternative school, all of whose children were kind of cast off from the public schools. And I looked at them as something that was, kind of outside of me. And then moving on to the district attorney's office as child abuse advocate. And it was really at that point that I realized that I wasn't different than any of those people or those children that I was helping, that the reason I understood them was because I had had many of those same experiences. And so I then moved into my position that I presently have, and it only took 60 years to get to the job that I think I was meant to do on this earth, and that is to be able to speak for children who can't speak for themselves. And so when I say I've come full circle, I'm so grateful that I now am in a position of a kind of strength, inner strength, and support from the community, where now I can speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. Because when I was a child, there was no vehicle that gave voice to children that were in pain.
Wow. Wow, that's all very touching, really, very, very touching.
Well, I don't mean to say those things as a victim, because I don't speak as a victim. In fact, if you took that out of the dictionary, it would be fine with me, because I don't want to come from that place. I just feel that if I hadn't had the experiences I had at the beginning, and I hadn't had some of the challenges, and met the people I met, and existed in the cultures I existed in that were so diverse, I couldn't do what I am able to do now. And so everything was for a purpose, and I do believe that we come here with a purpose, and I believe our job is to find that purpose, and I believe that I'm one of the lucky ones because I got to find mine.
You're right on target, yes. Wow. Well, it's very touching that you can do for others what wasn't there for you. That's the touching part.
I'm blessed.
Yes, yes. Could we talk a little bit about the center?
Yes.
I've looked at it on the website. Would you like to give your website?
Yes, it's www.cacjc.org, and it's a brand new site. We just had it built through a grant that we received, and I'm very excited about it because I think it's a joyful site, and it gives people a lot of information about child abuse. It really very clearly states what we do there, why we do it. It has a lot of educational information there. It has tools for prevention, which is something I really want to talk about tonight.
You
That's
bet.
Part of the paradigm shift that you mentioned earlier. We have a wonderful tour of the center on our website, which is called a cool video tour, because it's given by a child. And I always, when I give tours myself at the center, I always take the adults through the front door, and I tell them I want them to walk in the steps of the children, because our facility is really sacred ground, and you can feel the spirits of the children that have walked through there, and so I don't think anybody has ever walked through our center that hasn't felt that this was something that is bigger than just three buildings. And so a young lady is doing the tour.
How old is she?
She's about 12 years old.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Years old, just adorable. And our therapy dog is there, who is absolutely a consummate therapist. And he's our mascot. He's actually a great healer, if you can.
I believe
that animals have a sense about everything and the earth and people. And he's really able to get in touch with who needs what the most. And that's quite a skill to have. People go to school and never get that.
That's right. excuse me. He's just adorable. He's, what is it, Airedale? What is he?
Now, he is actually a Labradoodle. So he is a one-quarter lab and three-quarters poodle.
But he's very reasonably large and
on
this tight curly hair, and he just, on the video, he jumps up on the couch beside the little girl and cuddles and puts his head in her lap.
I know.
And just immediately.
That shot was done in one take, because that's what he does. He wasn't acting, obviously. He does what he was born to do, and that is to heal and to give love and comfort.
Yes.
And he knows exactly how to do that. It's really, the center has never had a therapy dog before, and we just got him this year, and his owner is Tony Richmond, one of our therapists, and she takes him home at night, although I think we would all like to take him home at night.
I bet.
And he's a healer also for us, who are working at the center, because sometimes some days are very, very difficult when we have cases that are, beyond anything that anybody can really assimilate into their heart and mind, and we have to deal with these kinds of things all the time. And sometimes we just go over to Jack to get a lick on the face, because that in itself it helps us with our, the trauma that comes in the door that we must deal with.
Yeah, yeah. I want to interrupt and say that this is, you're listening to Marlene Mish, who is the executive director of the Children's Advocacy Center of Jackson County, Medford, Oregon. Thank you. That is a beautiful, beautiful website, and I do hope that people will check it out.
Thank you. I hope so too.
Yes, and I was thinking that as I was watching it, it's so delightful and warm and loving, and all the while it's letting you know that children have been through horrible events and are being offered a safe place to tell their story.
That's right. Well, you know, when you think about it, I mean, I usually am concentrating on Jackson County, my little neck of the globe, but the fact of the matter is that 39 million people in this country are survivors of child abuse. 39 million.
Wow.
And that's what we think we know about. And And so that means that in your listening audience, there isn't one person probably that hasn't either been a victim, who knows someone who's been a victim, or who knows someone who's been a victim, but they don't, they haven't told them. And so because abuse has touched every single life, and when it touches one, it touches all of us, and it lasts for generations unless we intervene, and that's what our work at the center is about.
How large is your staff?
Well,
and is it mostly women?
We're all women,
mm-hmm.
except Jack, the therapy dog.
Yes.
He's allowed. we have 13 people, but only 10 and a half, full-time positions. So there are several people that are part-time. Last year, 915 children came to our center, mm-hmm. and we offered over 3,000 individual services. So you can see that there's a lot of work to be done and very few people to do it, and it would not be possible to be done without the help of our volunteers that come and help us do some jobs so that we can do others. So we have a wonderful community that cares very much about its children and about each other, and we have a number of wonderful organizations that help children. And we're lucky to have a volunteer force of about 40 people that help us do various things. But the core group is, 13 people.
That's remarkable. I'm thinking about here, and I'm not aware of there being any such facility.
Well, actually, I did a little homework.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm interested in Oregon, we have 22 centers. Advocacy centers, and in California you have 22 advocacy centers.
Uh-huh.
And I have a list of all of them here, and so yes, they do exist. You know, actually most people know say about CASA because it's a national brand.
Right.
Advocacy centers very often have very different names. They're named different things. And you could really go a lifetime without never knowing that one exists unless, unfortunately, you something happens in your family and you have to come to us. That's the bad news, because most people don't find out about us unless something really awful has happened to them or a loved one. The good news is that we're there because a little over 20 years ago in this country, there was no such thing as an advocacy center.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a child, if a child had the courage to come forward and say that somebody was hurting them, no matter what kind of abuse that was, law enforcement would get involved and maybe protective services. But by the time that child was dragged from pillar to post and had to tell their story a dozen times to a bunch of strangers who all were trying to help them, and perhaps then taken to an emergency room where they had to wait and maybe examined by a really well-meaning doctor, but who was not trained in the issues of child abuse. That's a relatively new field, 2 decades. That's the way it used to be. And then, all over the country, beginning in Huntsville, Alabama, but Oregon was right on the heels of that, they decided, and they were grassroots movements all over this country. It was almost like the 100th monkey kind of principle, that we realized that the system, the legal system, the child protective service system that was trying to help the child, the child was getting re-traumatized by the system that was trying to help them. And that really gave birth to the concept of an advocacy center, where all of the services happen in one place that looks like a home with familiar faces. And we have our own grand jury, which if you see the tour, we take you into the grand jury room so that the child does not have to go to the adult grand jury. The child tells their story, we hope, one time, so that, and that was, that's made into a DVD, and that can be used if we have to go to trial. Of course, ideally, we don't want to take a child to trial. We don't want a child to have to testify in a court of law in front of a bunch of strangers. Occasionally, we must do that. Ideally, we'd like the perpetrator to confess. that's not usually what perpetrators do.
Oh, that's what I was wondering, yeah.
No. In fact, there's, I think, an unspoken code that they, you know, they never did anything and they weren't there and they know nothing about it.
Uh-huh.
And they, of course, everybody's innocent. But we know from the facts, and we know that one in four girls, and I think these are statistics that are accepted by research. I don't think they're even close to what it really is, based on my experience talking to people. But officially, it's one in four girls and one in six boys in this country will be sexually abused before the age of 18.
Yeah.
And that is an unacceptable number by anybody's calculations.
It certainly is.
Right.
It certainly is. And it's been going on for a very long time.
It's been going on from the beginning of time. And
well, no, not from the beginning of time, from the beginning of patriarchy.
But yeah, well,
for the last 5,000 years.
That had a lot to do with it. I think that the problem that, and I speak specifically for our own country, although this is a global issue, the problem to really deal with this at all is the taboo about even talking about it.
Yep.
And this is one of my great challenges and the challenges of all of us who work in this field. It's not that when I come to speak to you that you're going to feel good, because I'm going to talk to you about things that you don't, not only don't want to hear, you don't even want to know. And you don't want to know it on a conscious level, and you don't want to know it on an unconscious level, because it is very difficult to have to get your mind around the fact that there are people in this world that will consciously, on purpose, break the sanctity of a child's innocence, and will do it day in and day out, week in and week out, year in and year out, until they're caught. And it's hard for people to hear things like that, because we don't want to think that mankind is capable of such atrocities, but that is a fact. But that makes it a challenge, and I think that when we've brought this issue out from it being a family problem, or in the past, if somebody would tell, they'd say, that's a family issue. And we've brought it from that place in the last 20 years or so, from it's a family issue to it's a crime. And that's a very, very important leap.
Yes, it is. Thank you, indeed. Excuse me, it's 7:32. You're listening to Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and I am here with Marlene Misch, the executive director of the Children's Advocacy Center of Jackson County, Medford, Oregon. Yes, indeed, it is. The taboo against talking about it, children not reporting it. I was mildly abused in the scale of such things, and never said a word. And my parents were 30 feet away.
That's right. Well, that is. I'm very sorry that that happened to you, but I'm happy that you said that, because that gives me an opportunity to tell your listeners something that's really important, is that most people think that the people that are sexually abusing children are strangers, when the fact is that only 10% of the people who sexually assault our children are strangers. 90% of the people who hurt our children are children that we know,
love, that you know,
trust, and would even defend. And they usually, the grooming process happens very, very often right in front of the family. It begins, someone begins desensitizing the child to inappropriate touch or things. They do it right in front of the family. And since we are so trained to be blind because of whatever our own family histories and filters are, that offenders are very, very clever to begin very subtle kinds of abuses right under the family's nose. And for the child, the young child, who then experiences that, and even if that child feels that something is wrong, the child looks up and everybody seems okay, and then you see what that could be the first step of many steps of grooming that make it possible for someone to remain close to the child and continue abusing that child until they are caught and stopped. And that's the only thing that will ever stop an offender from hurting a child. They must be stopped.
Yeah. Well, so you're saying they're most often a member of the family or a family friend.
Well, they're known to the family, known to the victim, and we have, unfortunately, a lot of interfamilial abuse. And number one, of course, is the father, stepfather, boyfriend to the mother. Then, you know, comes cousins and other grandfathers. And so it's within in the nuclear family and then the extended family. And then just acquaintances, neighbors, babysitters, coaches, priests, Boy Scout leaders, Girl Scout leaders, teachers, anyone, any place where children are, there will be people that will have their sole purpose in life is to offend those children.
Well, it's a sorry story.
Yeah, that's the bad news. But I would like to talk about what the good news is.
Okay,
and I hate to just talk about the bad, and I certainly could until late into the night, and that I don't think that would help us. But what I would like to talk about is how we can actually change this. And at our center, we're doing it through a program called Darkness to Light, Stewards of Children. But I just want to back up for a second. If you recall, if you had children, or remember how I remember how I raised my children, how my mother raised me. I remember, you get the lunch pail on the way to school, and you get the little coat and a little kiss on the cheek, and then the last thing that says is don't talk to strangers. And so what we were doing two things. One, we were telling the children that they were responsible to defend themselves from abusers. We were telling them that those abusers were strangers. Both of those things are not true. One, a child cannot defend herself or himself from someone who has the intent of using them for sexual exploitation. And two, they know that they're going to know the person. And so unwittingly, we as adults almost set our children up to be hurt because we didn't know any better. Now we have an opportunity to absolutely switch that paradigm shift when we realize that we are actually responsible for the children, and that by getting information and knowing that these are not 90% of the people are not going to be strangers that might hurt our children, we then tools in our toolbox that will allow us to protect our children. And that's what this program is about, and that's what we're trying to... I personally think that every adult in our country should have to take an educational course, this training, or another training like it. I'm not selling a training. But the idea that we are responsible for our children, a baby in a crib, cannot protect himself or herself from someone that wants to sexually abuse them. They can't pick up a phone. They can't do it. We have to know more than the abusers know about the tricks of their trade, how they gain access to our children, how they do it, how they get our favor, how they get us to turn off our red flag system. And with that knowledge, our eyes become open, and we see things that we never saw before, and then we take responsibility to act.
Could you tell us about some of those things to pay attention?
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, they're so simple that they're ridiculously simple, and they're just like, well, of course I know that, but it's the doing it that's the difference. So the first thing, obviously, is to understand all that you can about child abuse. One thing we need to know is that offenders are the smartest criminals around. Any law enforcement person, any prosecutor will tell you that. And to prove it is because they're able to get a child or children and offend from starting sometimes prepubescence all the way to death or to when they're incarcerated and never get caught. So they have some tricks up their sleeve. And so we need to know what those are, and we need to know what child abuse looks at. I spent many years in the classroom. Teachers are great people. We look up out of the class. We look at these little faces. But unless we know what to look for, we are blind. As soon as we have the tools of knowledge, we look up into that classroom, and we know what we're looking at. We can identify things that once we perhaps thought was something else, which was really abuse. Next, we need to minimize the opportunity, and that means that, and here's quite simply put, you can't sexually abuse a child if you don't have that child alone. And so we need to be very vigilant about who we allow our children to spend time alone with, who we entrust, our most precious being that's in our life, who we entrust those children with. And we need to put policies into place in our schools, in our child care centers, in our churches, in all of our places where children are, that minimize the opportunity where there would be one adult and one child. That is a formula that a child molester is just hoping will happen. If we reduce those, we can almost make it impossible for an abuser to get access to a child. Then we have to talk about it. We talked about the taboo. We have to forget it's not a taboo. It's a subject that we need to take responsibility for. We need to talk to our children about their bodies, about that their bodies belong to them. We need to give them permission to disobey adults if adults are wanting them to do something they do not want to do. We need to believe our children when they come and tell us things. The worst thing we can do is not believe our children, by the way. And we need to talk amongst ourselves, like we're doing right now, Janie, and I'm talking to you and your listeners, that we need to talk about this so that it's on our lips and it's not an uncomfortable topic. It's not a fun topic, but it's a topic that should be just as comfortable as anything when it's important enough to do something about. We need to stay alert. I advise mothers and fathers, if you think something feels wrong, it usually is. I think we've come very disassociated from our instinctual awareness of danger. We need to help our children know when they feel that feeling that they need to get away from that. And we ourselves, when we have a feeling that something doesn't feel right, someone wants to take our child out to on camping by themselves. Well, why would an adult want to do that? Why would a 17-year-old want to take a 8-year-old on a camping trip? 17-year-olds don't want to hang out with 8-year-olds. And so we need to let those red flags go up and say, wait a minute, that doesn't feel right. And then, you know, find out what's going on. We need to make a plan about what we're going to do if we sense that something's going on. And then we need to act. And that's really important because, you know, we can talk and we can read and we can take classes and we can take workshops and we can load ourselves with information for the end of time. But unless we are willing to put our intention into action, then our children will stay at risk and this problem will continue. When we move our intention to action and we are willing to take a risk and to do what's right for our children, then we have the upper hand over the people that hurt our children. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we need to get completely involved in this, one, by taking responsibility, and two, by finding that place in our community, in our world, in our family, where we can be of service. Maybe that's a volunteer at a center that's in your neighborhood. Maybe that's a volunteer at your church, or maybe that's just being the person that asks a child, are you okay? Are you okay? Do you want to talk about it? You never know. If you have information, when that information will be critical to the life of a child.
Yes. I'm going to interrupt one moment. We usually open up the lines now. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
The telephone number here is 937-5103, so please feel free to call in. Oh, please continue. What you're saying is so, so important.
Well, you know, I may sound outspoken, but I am. And and I really hope that somehow during this, you know, this time that we have together, which is so precious for everyone, is that people, you know, really kind of wake up and realize that this is happening all around us every day. And I know that I use an example in my trainings. If we heard as a people that, you know, that 25% of all of our children were going to be hit by a school bus before they were 18, yeah, I bet you that we would rise up in righteous indignation and we would put an end to that. Don't you?
Yes, I should think so.
But when I say to groups that 25 of our children will be sexually abused before they're 18, a silence falls across the room. Because then we are hit with that realization that we're being forced to look at something that we just don't want to look at.
Right.
And that is the hardest, you know, the hardest barrier to get over it. When we get over that barrier, there is great empowerment to know that each person that becomes empowered and gets the tools and the knowledge about this topic can perhaps save the life or save a child from suffering the what happens to a child when they are sexually abused. And the I wanted to tell you there was a in San Diego just a few years ago, there was a study done by the folks at Kaiser Permanente, and between 1995 and 1997, they took 17,000 of their patients and did a study on them. And these were upper-class people, educated people, and they had them fill out some forms about some of the things that they may have experienced as children, and, you know, like a divorce in the family or domestic violence or a death of a loved one or sex abuse or physical abuse or neglect or loss of a home, all these kind of risk factors. And what they found out, they weren't really going for this, but what they found out in the end of that study was that the people that had three or more of these, what they called adverse childhood events, had three or more of those, really had 20 years chopped off of their lifespan because of the physical and mental illnesses that they got. Now, how does that happen? Now, I don't think that I personally, and you probably not either, I don't need a medical study of 17,000 people to tell me that if something bad happens to me in my childhood, it's going to affect me.
Yes.
But to have a study like this gives validity to things that we know intuitively, is that what happens to us matters.
Oh, here we have a phone call.
Good.
Good, good, good. Hello, you're on Women's Voices.
Yes, thank you for tackling this very difficult topic.
Thank you.
I'm curious if the guest does outreach in high schools, given that so much of the perpetration is within the family and, unfortunately, the father of children. It's understandable that a wife, mother, particularly if she's young, cannot imagine that her husband, lover, the father of her child, would perpetrate such things. So my question is outreach and education being done in the schools about this to help that sort of situation? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, I think that's a really relevant question and one that's very much on my mind right now, because I'm in the process of going to all the superintendents in our school districts and asking that we be allowed to go into the schools and give child sex abuse prevention information to the teachers is my first phase, and then to the parents. Where do our children spend all their time? There are people who see our children much more than we do, and they're called teachers. I know, because I was one. And teachers have access to children in ways that we can't, the average person can't imagine unless you've spent a lifetime in a school. And so if we can get our schools to make this part of the curriculum for the teachers and the adults, and then, of course, have the other side of that, and that is protective information and education in the health classes for the kids, this should start the first day of school when the child leaves for preschool. This is when this education needs to begin. And then it needs to continue all through the child's education. If we did that, and we have some, we have a county in Oregon, Deschutes County, their advocacy center now has this, these programs in all the school districts in the county. In counties like that, and it just starts in a, you know, it has to start just someplace. You can start in the middle. You don't have to start at the beginning. And we need, if we did that, we would see, I want to say we could see the obliteration of this kind of abuse.
Yeah, it would be stopped in its tracks. I wanted to ask you about the children who aren't helped and who grow up with this heavy, heavy psychic wound. We have a case here in our community. I think I've mentioned it to you that
Aaron.
Yes, yes, and in that little video that you saw regarding his life, someone else spoke up that their brother, who had also been abused by this same person, as an adult, committed suicide, and and that's, I take it, that's not terribly unusual.
No, it isn't, and that is why I'm really an advocate for early intervention. If we can get these children when they come forward and help them, they have a chance to heal. That's another part of the good news, is that it is possible to heal. Not that you're going to forget, but it is possible to heal. What happens when we don't intervene or a person chooses not to get help or not to tell? We all know, as human beings, we can push those feelings down, but eventually, like grief itself, they are going to come back. And they're going to come back in unexpected ways. And what they, and the way they come back in our children, is that they come back in very destructive ways. My experience, and I think all the literature will back me up there, is that you get kids who hate themselves. They hate their bodies. They have very low self-esteem. They do not do well at school. They drop out of school. There's early pregnancy. There's the repetition of abuse. You're really, it's almost like you have a target sign that says, abuse me, you know, because once you've been abused, the chances of being abused again go up. Mm-hmm. The chances of you continuing that cycle into your own life when you have children go up. A lot of times children are abused, I talked about infants and toddlers, before they have language. Mm-hmm. So abuse cannot even be articulated because the pain happened before they had the cognitive ability to express it in language. And then you have a situation where you wake up, you know, you grow up and you don't quite feel right and you don't feel a part of things and you're just kind of off. And then one day you look around and you say, you know, why am I abusing drugs? Why can't I have a relationship? Why don't I trust anybody? Why am I in my fourth marriage? Why am I always afraid? Why have I tried to commit suicide? Why am I a cutter? Why am I, you know, and the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
And that is what happens when we try to pretend like it didn't happen, or if it happens when we're very, very young and no one knows about it.
We have another call. Can we take that? Hi, you're on Women's Voices.
Hi, could your guest give us some things that parents should be looking for in their children, the signs in their children that might give them a hint that someone is that their child is being sexually abused? And can she also speak to the fact that children who are sexually abused are often also physically abused, and the interaction between the two of those? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
An excellent question. First, I just want to say, just to validate what your caller has said, there's no such thing as, if you look at a person as like a pie chart, there's no such thing that everything is just hunky-dory in that person's life and there's a little sliver of sex abuse. That's not the way it works. These are overlapping abuses where the child may be sexually abused. There's always emotional abuse going on. There may be neglect going on, physical abuse. These things come in clusters. And so it is your caller is absolutely correct. These things go together, and they only play off of each other and really make for a terrible life for any child. As far as the kind of signs that you need to be looking for, some children show no signs at all, but most children will indicate some signs. And let me just give you a few. Redness and rashes and swellings around the genital area when there's no reason for it. Frequent urinary tract infections in little girls. Physical problems, chronic anxiety, nightmares, withdrawal. With children, they can get very aggressive and angry and be the kid that's fighting everybody, or they can be very withdrawn and not talk to anybody. So it can be everything. It can be the whole spectrum. If a child has been potty trained and for some time and then suddenly comes back from camp or comes back from a weekend sleepover and now is wetting the bed, that is an absolute red flag. If I had 3 years, they would all perk up. As the kids get older, you have kids knowing things about sexual activity that they could not possibly know for their age. So you have, let's say, a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old acting out oral sex or maybe they're trying to have sex with their toys. They're sticking objects into the vaginal or anal area of an animal or a toy. This is not normal behavior. This is different than childhood curiosity. This is that means that child has been exposed to something or hurt, and that needs to be paid attention to. If they sometimes they will try to harm themselves. And so my experience when I was a counselor, I don't think I ever saw a girl that was cutting herself that wasn't also being sexually abused. So cutting, depression, all of those things are really big red flags. I'd really pay attention. And one thing that parents are really afraid to do, and that is one thing, ask. They're really afraid to ask. They're afraid to ask, is anybody hurting you? And it's okay to tell me the truth.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds so simple.
Yes, it sounds simple, but it's not. That's why we're in the situation we are. It's very hard for a parent to have that kind of openness. But without that kind of openness with our children, they're not going to tell us because they don't want to hurt us. They don't want to upset us. They don't want dad to be taken from the home and then the home to be lost. Abusers are very skillful in saying, this is your fault. I've read police reports where an abuser is being interviewed by the police, and this, it's all documented, and he's saying, well, this girl came on to me, she was all over me, she's so sexually precocious, and she was, doing a lap dance and everything, and the next question was, and how old is this girl? 5. So right there you see that the mind of the sex offender is not a normal mind. He often can really believe that he is having a consensual relationship with a child when, in fact, he is not having a consensual relationship. Right. He is hurting this child.
Of course. What happens to these people? Do they get put away? I mean, what's your record on that? How is that
well,
work?
We have, obviously, all states have laws around these, all kinds of sex abuse. In Oregon, we have something called Measure 11, and a Measure 11 is a crime that if a child is under the age of 8 or under the age of 12 or whatever, they would have minimum mandatory sentences for certain sex crimes, and those can be, 6 years. I mean, they can be extensive amounts of time. But that's a tough question because nothing is tough enough as far as I'm concerned.
I'm sure. We're running out of time. This has been a wonderful show. I'm so appreciative of your work, and we will be in touch. I'm so sorry. It's just happening. It gets away.
I know. I'm so grateful to have had an opportunity to talk to you all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marlene.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night.
Our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play.